Welcome once again to our program, The Salvation History as Recorded in the Old Testament. The story of the creation, fall of Adam and Eve that affected and infected all of us, and the beginning of the healing or the liberation or the redemption of all humankind. Our guest once again is Ron Eldred, who is our teacher at John Paul II Catholic High in religion and history and government. Ron, welcome once again to the program. And I think in this eighth episode, having finished with the flood stories, now we're coming to the covenant God made with Noah and his family after the flood, as delineated in the Old Testament. Didn't God make a covenant with Noah after the flood?
Yes, this is part of the first phase of this series, which is the book of Genesis, essentially. And yes, God did make a covenant with Noah. This was the second covenant that he had made with humans since the creation, the first being with Adam and Eve after the fall, which we discussed, I think, in about our second, maybe our third session. After the flood, Noah and his family are the beginning of a new creation. As soon as the waters had subsided, Noah offered a sacrifice to God in thanksgiving. God, in turn, made a new covenant or a new agreement, a new sacred agreement, with Noah, making him the second father of humankind. God promised Noah that, quote, never again will all life be cut off by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you. A covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth. So God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant I have established between me and all life on the earth. This is found in Genesis 9, 11 through 17. And the Catechism says of this covenant, quote, God made an everlasting covenant with Noah, with all living beings. It will remain enforced as long as the world lasts. End of quote. And after that, God told Noah and his family to be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly on the earth, and multiply it in it. End of quote.
Okay, Ron, doesn't the flood also have a deeper meaning or sense than just the record of a specific event in history?
Yes, I think it does. The flood symbolizes the waters of baptism. Christians have always said that. Moreover, the ark, not the Ark of the Covenant now that we'll be talking about later, but the boat, the big boat we just talked about in the last couple of sessions. The ark prefigures the church, and we find this in St. Peter, 1 Peter 3:20. Because the waters of baptism are offered to save all of humanity. To quote Scott Hahn on this matter, quote, Christians see the flood as a type, a symbolic precursor in history of Christian baptism. The story in Genesis tells us in a symbolic way what happens when a Christian is baptized. Our old world of sin is washed away. We are created anew, reborn in the waters of baptism. Like Noah, we still carry the potential of sin with us after baptism, but we have received God's blessing and his promise that he will not destroy us.
Okay, now, although God's covenant with Noah gave a new beginning to all humanity, the flood obviously didn't eliminate sin.
No, it certainly didn't. Noah might have been a righteous man, but he certainly wasn't perfect. As Han reminds us, he, like every human, inherited Adam and Eve's sinful nature. In spite of the fact that God knew that humans would sin again, he said, "Would I will never again curse the ground because of man." And God blessed Noah and his family, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." Of these words, Han says, quote, "Those are the same words God spoke to Adam and Eve at the dawn of creation. And he did with Adam and Eve, as he did with Adam and Eve. God gave Noah and his family dominion over the living things of the earth." Still quoting from Scott Hahn. In fact, the story of Noah and the story of Adam are so similar that we can see a literary genius at work. The inspired author uses literary parallelism to leave us no doubt that the flood begins a new creation. God gave them the earth and all its goods to have a dominion over them, for there was conditions. A covenant goes two ways, a blessing for abiding by its conditions and a curse for breaking it. That's the end of his quote. And this encapsulates the theme of the book of Deuteronomy, which we haven't gotten to yet, but we certainly will spend quite a bit of time on when we get there, that God will reward his people when they obey his commandments, and he punish them when they break them. That's what's called in Old Testament biblical scholarship theme, and it permeates the entire Old Testament. It'll come up again and again and again. Again, the theme that God rewards his people or even individuals when they obey his commandments, and they're punished when they break the covenant, when they break.
Of course, and we can see that still exists.
Sure, right on down to the present day.
If we walk in the way of the Lord, blessing. If we walk in the broad and narrow way that leads to destruction, we end up destroying ourselves or others.
Well, of course, the world lives under a new and everlasting covenant today. That's the covenant that Jesus made with his Father on behalf of the whole human race, especially his church, of course, the Catholic Church, of which everyone, either directly or indirectly, can be a member.
Now, doesn't Han go on to say in many places that the word covenant, agreement, pact between God and his people is the theme that runs through the Old Testament and the New Testament?
Yeah, because the word covenant and testament, they're just interchangeable terms, of course.
Okay. We even call it the New Testament,
yes,
and the Old Testament.
Or the Old Covenant and the New and Everlasting Covenant, or New Testament. Noah's very significant to our story because after the flood, all human beings allegedly descended from him. Now, that could be debated a lot, you know, if you get into anthropology and archaeology and all that kind of thing, and that's something that we don't want to, you know, spend a lot of time doing, of course, but I have read estimates that the flood occurred around 2200 B.C. And, of course, if that were the case, we know that there were lots and lots of people living around the world at that time that didn't live in that part of the world. But we talked about that issue in the earlier sessions. You know, was the flood a worldwide event, or was it just some local Middle Eastern event, which, of course, the people who wrote Genesis knew about but didn't know, you know, about, let's say, the Maya and the Aztecs and who weren't there yet, but in the Chinese and you know, people living in the deepest parts of Africa and certain developing civilizations about that time.
But you also did mention in the discussion that almost all civilizations have a flood story,
yes,
in their culture.
There's hardly a people that doesn't, which of course is probably a good sign that it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Not the opposite. A lot of times anthropologists or historians will say, well, because Christians have this belief and pagan people had it a long time ago, then it must not be true. We just borrowed it from them. Mm-hmm. Even if we did borrow it, that still doesn't mean it wasn't true.
Yeah.
But the book of Genesis traces the genealogy of Abraham about 350 or 400 years back to Noah. We find this in Genesis 10 and 11, chapters 10 and 11. And some scholars believe that the flood occurred as early as 3000 B.C. and was connected with the end of the last ice age, but that kind of thing, you know, really doesn't matter too much to the overall story, of course.
Okay, since the flood didn't wash away sin, doesn't the sin of Noah's son, Ham, then bring a curse on his son, Canaan?
Yes. Once the flood waters receded, Noah and his family had to start human society and culture all over again, at least in that part of the world.
Okay.
First, they had to find food for themselves and their animals. Noah, he became a farmer to make a living for him and his family. And one of his crops was grapes. And at harvest time, he made wine from the grape juice. Unfortunately, Noah drank too much of his own wine, and as a result became drunk, lying naked in his tent. Most people are familiar with that story, of course. His son Ham, of his three sons, his Ham saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers, Shem and Japheth. And out of respect for their father, the two sons, I'll quote from Genesis here, took a garment, laid it upon their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away. They did not see their father's nakedness, end of quote. That's being quoted again from Genesis 9. When he awakened, Noah knew what Ham had done. So he cursed his son Canaan, Ham's son Canaan. And he said, quote, cursed be Canaan, a slave of slaves shall he be to his brothers. He also said, blessed be the Lord my God, be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave. God enlarged Japheth, let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his slave. End of quote. This is found in Genesis 9.
Okay, now Genesis 10 tries to account for all the peoples who repopulated the world after Noah. What can you tell us about this?
The genealogy of Noah's three sons is given in this chapter of Genesis, Genesis 10. The writer tries to account for all the peoples of the world at the time of the writing. For example, it claims that, and I'll quote, Canaan became the father of Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, the Arvadites, the Semerites, and the Hamathites. Afterward, the families of the Canaanites spread abroad, and the territory of the Canaanites extended from Sidon in the direction of Gerar, as far as Gaza, and in the direction of Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboiim, as far as Lasha. These are the sons of Ham by their families, their languages, their lands, and their nations, end of quote. These are all peoples descending from Canaan's sons. And what the writer is trying to account for are the peoples who occupied the land of Canaan, all these people we just mentioned there a while ago. The land of God was later to promise to Abraham and his descendants, a story that we'll soon be getting to. The land that Abraham's descendants are going to have to take away from these peoples, usually by violence, by war. Recall we said earlier that Abraham was a descendant of Shem, whose family line the writer also lists. Biblical scholars have called chapter 10 of Genesis the Table of Nations, because it tries to account for the development of all of the nations of the world following Noah and the flood. Scott Hahn sums it up nicely, I think, in his book, Understanding the Scriptures, where he says, quote, Noah and his sons are all descendants of Adam. They carry original sin with them. Ham's disrespect undermined his father's authority at a time when his was the only authority. His sin earned a curse on his descendants, in particular on Canaan, regarded as the father of the Canaanites, hated enemies of Israel. Noah therefore gave his blessing to Shem, one of two cases in Genesis where the firstborn son didn't succumb to pride and end up being passed over in favor of the younger brother.
Okay, now, tough question, Ron. Hasn't the curse of Ham or Canaan been used to justify the enslavement of certain peoples over the centuries because he said they would be their slaves?
Yes, unfortunately, it has. In other words, if all of the human race comes from those three, you know, men, which, of course, technically, maybe it didn't, but nonetheless, for our purposes, we'll assume that it's true. Unfortunately, of course, it has been a big problem. The curse of Ham or his son Canaan refers to the curse that Ham's father Noah placed on Ham's son, as we said, on Ham's son Canaan, after Ham saw his father's nakedness, when Noah's was found drunk in the tent. And the curse has often been used as a rationalization to justify slavery of certain peoples over the ages, especially the black Africans, who were believed to be descendants of Ham. This racist theory was pretty commonly held between the 18th and 20th centuries, but it largely fell in disuse since the mid-20th century. But I remember, of course, I taught American history for years and studied it, and in addition to European history, and quite frequently you would come across this curse of Ham as justifying slavery, especially in the antebellum South. It was a very common one of the rationalizations, or you might say excuses, for the existence of slavery, or trying to justify slavery.
So, and of course, the Bible was so important to so many people at that time, and here they were, the scriptures themselves saying, well, this is God's plan, according to the way they were understanding this account of Noah and his sons. So it was deeply rooted in what people call the scriptures themselves.
Yes.
Well, okay, haven't some scholars even argue that the story of Noah and his sons is a myth? What can you say about that?
Well, another way of phrasing the question is it really a true, really true history? And as I've said several times during this and in other series that we've had, the Bible wasn't intended to be a scientific or history textbook in the modern sense, but there probably is some historical truth, maybe a lot of historical truth, in this story. The Bible doesn't teach error, but we need to know what the author of a text is trying to say. Does he mean it literally, or does he mean it in a deeper spiritual, allegorical sense? And only the church, of course, can really ultimately define those kind of things for us, as we've tried to point out before. I don't think that it would be too hard to have an entire series, for example, of programs dealing with what historians and biblical scholars have had to say about just this subject alone.
It's a really tough subject.
Yes.
And as you say, we don't have time to go into it right now. Let's continue our story about from Genesis. What about the story of the Tower of Babel? Most people have heard of that story, as well as Noah and the flood, who know anything about the Bible. What about the Tower of Babel?
Well, of course, this is another one of those Bible stories that all children, of course, learn on their mommy's knee or at their Bible school or places of that sort. After the genealogies that we discussed a while ago, comes another of the most famous stories in the Bible, and that is the story of the Tower of Babel, or Babel, that's found in Genesis 11. According to Scott Tahn in his textbook, Understanding the Scriptures, the Hamites, that is the descendants of Noah's son Ham, remember the one who was cursed, or at least his son Canaan was cursed, they tried to build the Tower of Babel to usurp the authority of the Shemites. Remember the Shemites, the sons of Shem, they were the ones who were the good ones, and the good son, the faithful son, along with Japheth, his brother. As I said earlier, biblical scholars have called chapter 10 of Genesis the Table of Nations because it tells which nations came from each of Noah's sons. Hans says that, quote, the most interesting list is the descendants of Ham. And then it lists there Egypt, Canaan, Philistia, you know, from which the Philistines, and we'll talk a lot about the Philistines later on, Assyria and Babylon, all come from Ham's line. And we're going to be talking about each one of those peoples quite a bit in the next number of sessions. In other words, all the nations that were the enemies of the Israelites are descendants of the wicked Ham. The people of Israel would see this list as a rogue's gallery, according to of evil oppressors, according to Scott Hahn. He goes on to say, quote, on the other hand, the descendants of Shem would be the ancestors of the people of God. His great-grandson, Eber, gave his name to the Hebrews, end of quote. Now, according to Genesis 11, the descendants of Ham, who settled in the plain of Shinar, that is, ancient Mesopotamia, or sometimes it was called Sumeria back in those days, which is modern Iraq, decided to make a name for themselves. Come, quote, this is from the book of Genesis, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top to the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. End of quote. Regarding the Tower of Babel, Han tells us that the Hebrew word for name is Shem. He says that the Hamites intended to make Shem for themselves, a name for themselves. What this means is that they are rebelling against the covenant authority given to Noah's son Shem. They are so arrogant and puffed up with pride that they think they can reach heaven by building a tower rather than by reaching heaven by God's way. Since God had promised Noah that he would never destroy the earth again, he stops them by confusing their language. In other words, he couldn't destroy the world anymore because he promised in the covenant with nobody. No, he wouldn't. So he stops them by confusing their language. Before this time, the book of Genesis tells us that all the world's people had spoken the same language. But after they tried building the tower to heaven, they suddenly couldn't understand each other. Consequently, the people who had their languages confounded or confused simply stopped building their city, according to the story, and scattered from there all over the earth. The city and tower that they started to build wasn't destroyed, however. The city came to be known as Babel or Babylon. And Han says that, quote, it would become the symbol of everything that was evil and decadent, end of quote. And of course, Babylon will come up again and again and again. It even comes up today, even when people a lot of times refer to Babylon, they're usually talking about some evil place.
And book Revelation talks about Babylon.
Yes, it does, sure.
The evil, which many Protestants for a long time identified with the Catholic Church.
Oh, yes. The whore of Babylon and the church and the Pope was the Antichrist.
Well, you know, even the English word Babel means to talk in a way I can't understand what you're saying, just babbles on, and it's not making any sense. So it's even come over into our English language. Do you think that the story of the Tower of Babel was meant to be true in the modern sense of history?
Probably not. Nonetheless, there was a temple or temples built by the peoples of the era and area called ziggurats. And today the ruins of Babylon are on the east bank of the Euphrates River, about 70 miles south of modern Baghdad. You know, where there's so much trouble going on in Iraq. Babylon was the capital of 10 Mesopotamian royal dynasties, starting with the dynasty of King Hammurabi, 792 to 750 BC, somewhere around there, who was the sixth king of the first dynasty. And the last and greatest Babylonian dynasty created a great empire that stretched from what is modern-day Iraq to Egypt, or Iran and to Egypt. It reached its height of wealth and power under the king Nebuchadnezzar II, whom we will have a lot to say about when we get to the Babylonian exile period in the 7th century B.C. A ziggurat, named the Temple of the Foundation of Heaven and Earth, was dedicated to Marduk in the city of Babylon. And he was the patron deity of the city of Babylon, and according to one source was a fertility god, but originally a god of thunderstorms. And he was acknowledged as the creator of the universe and of humankind, the god of light and life, and the ruler of destinies. Another source says that Marduk, a ziggurat, was built by Nabopolassar and his son Nebuchadnezzar II. So that wouldn't have been until the actually 7th century. So there was a building there, but it was much later than what this story in Genesis is telling us about. But that's probably the one they were referring to. It was very big. It was like a pyramid, only it was stepped, mm-hmm. a stepped pyramid. At the top there was a temple. Scott Hahn sums the story of the Tower of Babel nicely in his textbook, Understanding the Scriptures, where he writes, quote, "The most impressive thing in any Mesopotamian city would have been its ziggurat, a huge pyramid-like structure with a temple on top. Archaeologists tell us that three temple mounds were more than high buildings. They were representations of the mountains where the gods were believed to live. The ziggurat was an artificial mountain of the gods. By building the ziggurats, the Mesopotamians thought they were literally reaching heaven. In fact, the ziggurats were so important to their religion that in Mesopotamian mythology, the cities and their ziggurats existed before human beings were created. Many scholars believe that the story of the Tower of Babel refers to the huge ziggurat that was built in Babylon. Like the Hamites in the story of Babel, the people who built the ziggurats thought they could build a tower to heaven. The ziggurat of Ur in southern Iraq dates to about 2100 B.C. So although I think that there is strong evidence that the biblical account of the Tower of Babel contains a lot of truth, I don't think that the events happened exactly as the story is related in Genesis 11. And keep in mind, as we said a while ago, the Bible wasn't intended to be an exact scientific or historical account. Its principal purpose is to help us to get to heaven, not how the heavens go.
Okay, tough question. We only have a couple of minutes. What about the confusion of language? Is the Genesis account of the formation of the world's languages meant to be taken literally?
No, I don't think so. Scholars tell us that there are a number of ancient traditions around the world that describe a divine confusion of the one original language into several languages, and some of them without a tower. Other sources mention 70 or 72 languages scattered from Babel. Although I don't think that the story of the confusion of languages is literally true, it is intended to stress the truth. One scholar states that the Genesis account presents the diversity of languages as a divine judgment upon human arrogance and pride.
Okay, well, our time is running out. We'll continue this in our next round, Ron. To our listening audience, may God bless you all, always and always.